and welcome to the Science Podcast for September 19th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, a cold comet containing particles formed at hot temperatures. Tracing a group of Yale science graduates 10 years after getting their doctorates, only one of the 26 has tenure, and trusting science information on the World Wide Web. All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Chondrules are millimeter-sized grains of minerals formed by extremely rapid heating to temperatures around 1500 degrees Celsius, subsequent melting, and then cooling within a few hours. They may be the oldest solid material in our solar system, and many of the meteorites that fall to Earth are made up of these chondrules. How, then, does a cold comet from way out in the Kuiper Belt end up with objects that closely resemble these hot-formed particles? Tomoki Nakamura and colleagues suggest the answer requires a different model for how the solar system formed. The team analyzed these chondrule-like particles captured from a comet by the Stardust space mission and report their findings in a paper in this week's Science. I spoke with Nakamura from Fukuoka, Japan, where he works at Kyushu University.
I found four chondrules from the particle recovered from short-period comet. The chondrules formed by high-temperature processes, more than 1,500 degrees Celsius. Therefore, it is unexpected that the low-temperature comet contains such a high-temperature material. And our analysis indicates that the chondrules in the comet is very similar to chondrules in asteroids. This suggests that the chondrules in the comet came from the inner solar system. Therefore, the chondrules were transported to the outer solar system.
What's the orbit of this short-period comet?
Now, the comet on the orbit between Jupiter and Mars, and the period is about 6 years.
So that's where the asteroid belt is.
Very similar to that, yes.
But it had been out in the Kuiper Belt?
Yes. Before 1974, the comet was on the orbit between Kuiper Belt and Jupiter. But at 1974, the comet came close to Jupiter, and the gravity of Jupiter changes the orbit of the comet. After that, the comet was on the orbit between Jupiter and Mars.
So there's no model that suggests that the Kuiper Belt ever reached the temperatures needed to make these chondrule-like particles?
No. In the inner solar system, there are a kind of high density of gases. And if you accelerate gases to high velocity and hit the solid particle, then the temperature of the solid particle becomes higher to reach the melting point of the dust. However, in the outer solar nebula, the gas density is very low. Therefore, even if the gas hits a dust particle, the temperature of the dust particle cannot reach the melting point of the dust. Therefore, it seems impossible to make chondrules in the early solar nebula.
It's not likely, then, that the comet picked up these particles when it changed orbit, but that these were particles that were part of the comet from when it was formed?
I think if the chondrule from asteroid hit the comet, then the chondrule show the evidence of high velocity impact. But such evidence is absent from chondrule I found. Therefore, I think the chondrule we found is already present when the comet formed.
So the particles that were found inside the Stardust space mission did not show evidence of high impact?
Yeah. I understand your question, and it's very, I think, important to have solid evidence. I have to measure the age of formation of chondrules using isotopes. If the chondrules we found show very old age, then the chondrule is very old and incorporated into comet very early. So it is very important to measure the timing of formation of chondrules that we found.
So that in addition to the impact evidence, the age of those chondrules would have been different if they had come from an asteroid and slammed into the comet.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
What are the broader implications for this discovery?
I hope my discovery will change the view of solar system formation. It is unexpected that the chondrules, which is the major component of asteroid, also present in the comet. Therefore, my discovery indicates that the material composing both asteroid and comet are quite similar, and this is totally unexpected. Therefore, the current solar system formation models are revised in various degrees.
Tomoki Nakamura, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much.
Tomoki Nakamura is lead author of a paper on chondrule-like objects in a short-period comet. Read the paper in this week's Science. Going into graduate school in science, you might think you'll become a tenured professor, run your own lab, and work with grad students of your own. And that's what each of the students entering Yale's Molecular Biophysics and Biochemistry program in 1991 thought they would do too. A prestigious program, the students had good reason to bet they'd succeed in getting the relatively rare tenure-track positions, but most of the 26 graduates chose to pursue other paths. And now, a decade after getting their doctorates, only one who followed the academic track has tenure. Science Deputy News Editor Jeffrey Mervis has traced their various paths and writes about it in this week's issue.
We wanted to look at the experiences of one graduate class going through an elite program in the biomedical sciences and what's happened to them 10 years after graduation.
What class did you choose and why?
We chose the Yale class of 1991 in the Molecular Biophysics and Biochemistry program, which turned out to be an unusually large class. But we chose it partly because they also were a fairly cohesive group and had stayed in touch, which made it a little bit easier for us to find these people 10 years later.
How many were in the class and what happened to them?
There were 30 that started, which turns out to be more than twice the normal size for reasons that no one could quite explain. 4 of them dropped out within a year, but 26 got their PhDs in either 1997 or 98 and went off to the rest of their careers. What's interesting is, I think, for a lot of scientists, how few of them are in academia. There's a total of 7, of which 6 are doing research. Only 2 are in tenure-track positions, and only 1 has tenure. At the same time, about a half of them are in the biotech or related industries doing science, and all of them say that their PhD has been valuable and given them skills that they needed to do well in the world.
So overall, about 2/3 of them, it sounds like, are using their degree in some capacity. The rest are not. What are they doing?
Well, there's a few that we couldn't find, so we're not sure about 3 of them. One of them is a patent lawyer, although she's working with startup companies, often in the biotech area. And a couple others are in the IT industry, software and related informatics.
Now, you mentioned that you're just looking at one class. Is this one class representative of the career trajectories of people in science and other universities?
Well, the interesting thing about that is you can't answer that question. And that's because universities do a very poor job of tracking their graduates. Professors individually know what happened to some of their students, especially those that stay in academia. But as a whole, it's rare for a program to know what's happened. And there's a lot of people that feel that information would be very helpful for incoming students to actually know what happened to their predecessors.
So from the university's standpoint, the business model here is?
To educate people and send them out into the world. Most of the students, the graduates that I talked to, felt that they got little or no career training. And even though that's changed a little, I suspect it hasn't changed as much as it needs to.
Was there something about the experience of the program itself that pushed them off into different career trajectories, or was it going in? They knew they just weren't interested in being academics.
Yeah, well, going in, they said to a person, and the class was evenly divided between men and women, I should point out, everyone expected to be running their own lab at a Research One university when they started because they didn't know anything else. And their advisors, as they went through the graduate program, assumed that because that's what they had done. It was only as they were getting their training that they started to look around and either decided, I'm not interested in academia, there are negative things about academia, there are positive things about industry or there are positive things about other fields. But the important point, I think, is that they had to make those choices on their own. To the extent that this class actually formed seminars on alternative careers because they felt the need to bring in other voices. That didn't continue, however, because as this class left, interest waned and it didn't become institutionalized. But people felt there was obviously an unfulfilled need for this kind of information.
Now, in 97-98, that was a time when the NIH was about to get all of this funding, this beginning of the budget doubling. So it's not funding necessarily that keeps people from going into academia.
Right. There's a lot of scientists who feel that the tight budget currently is driving people out of academia. But all of the graduates that I talked to felt that they had made their choices independently, that had they chosen to go into academia, they could have made it. But the fact is that they felt that there were other things that they were more interested in doing or other environments that they were more interested in working in, and there was no shame in not going into academia. In fact, a couple of them said explicitly that that was a new concept for them and an energizing one once they realized that they didn't have to follow in the footsteps of their advisor.
What did the advisors say when you came back to them with these numbers and said, here's where that class of 1991 went?
They said, gee, I would have expected the percentage to be higher. But then when I pressed them, they said, of course, we're not trying to force them into a mold and that there are several destinations on the road to becoming someone who's capable of doing independent science. And statistically, this shows that the 93% solution, which is the number who are not in tenure-track positions, should probably be considered the norm rather than the alternative career. But I think most departments, working in industry is still considered an alternative rather than a mainstream career.
Jeffrey Mervis, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob.
Science Deputy News Editor Jeffrey Mervis writes about a group of Yale science graduates and where they are a decade after getting their doctorates. Read his article in this week's Science. Science is based on trust and knowing who produced what, how, and where. But as Jim Golbeck writes in a perspective in this week's Science, trusting scientific information on the World Wide Web is difficult because of the overwhelming amount of user-generated content. And often that content is filled with opinions, inaccuracies, and even deception. So it's important to know how to filter that kind of information out. One of the ways is by using social trust relationships. I spoke with Golbeck about it from her office at University of Maryland College Park.
The basic idea behind this is that there's all kinds of user-generated content coming onto the web, and really it's becoming one of the dominant forms of information that people interact with, whether it's blog posts or pictures that people upload. There's a lot of it. And because there's so much of it now, it's coming from people that most users don't know. So it's hard to know which of this information is good and which of it's bad. If you're talking about tagging images, that might not be as critical, but if you're using these for, say, scientific purposes, so if you're taking pictures that people have posted from their backyard where they're showing plants, and you want to use that in a scientific study of invasive species, it's important to know if you can trust whether or not those users have, say, correctly labeled the kind of plant that's in the picture. So the idea that I present here is on using trust between people, whether it's direct, so I know someone and know how much I trust them, or indirect, and I rely on a bunch of the different methods that are out there to infer trust, to use that and apply it to filtering that information. So basically, you understand how much you trust the person who's created it, and you use your trust in that person to filter out information from people you don't know or who may not be so reliable.
So this is trusting people in networks of people, not necessarily other scientists.
That's right. I apply the idea generally where you can just have a social network. It's not necessary to have a social network, but it helps, and use that to determine how much to trust people. Now, you can do this in the context of other scientists. So there are a couple projects out there who actually are building social networks of scientists for really this kind of purpose. But I think it applies more generally, whether you're looking at scientists or just users on the web.
More particularly, then, in your view, what's needed to improve this trust of science on the web?
Well, it's a pretty new area. So there's you know, a good number of people working on understanding how much to trust people, but that's really only been done, say, for 3 or 4 years. It's a pretty new space. And we're just starting to understand what are good ways to infer how much to trust someone you don't know. And it hasn't been examined thoroughly in the context of scientific information. So you've seen it done a lot for, say, recommender systems where you're recommending movies or music, social trust between people. But in the context of science, you have this added feature where there's a right and a wrong. So if you're talking about, you know, is Titanic a good movie? Some people will say yes and some people will say no, but there's not really a right answer. If you're talking about science and, say, whether or not a piece of information is correctly labeled, there is a right and a wrong answer, or at least there's more of a truth to it than you'd get in something that's totally opinion-based.
How would one measure, or are people measuring, social trust in scientific contexts?
So the way that this is generally done in the literature on computing with social trust, we are either working with social networks where people have said outright how much they trust other people, or we're inferring it from looking at how similar they are on data we know. So you could take people who have rated a bunch of movies in common, and there's research out there on how to infer trust based on the similarity that those people have in their ratings. That's generally, in the context of scientific information, it's a little trickier because there aren't a lot of social networks out there of scientists. There are a few projects, and they're also looking at trust. But that's a very new area of research, actually applying this sort of social trust into the scientific context. And it's complicated by this issue that science is not just a matter of opinion. There's fact and opinion that go into it. So it's a space where I think there's a lot of research to be done. We really need to look at how you can compute trust between scientists that captures both their similarity in opinions, which certainly come into it, but also, you know, keep in mind that there's authority and there's correctness, and some people are experts and deserve to be trusted more because of that.
Suppose it is implemented, this social trust network for scientists. What would be the limitations of this kind of thing?
Well, it's important to find the correct places to apply it. So, for example, if we're just looking at testing whether or not someone is correct, social trust is not going to give you a big benefit there. If I have a picture of, say, a dandelion, and I label it as a picture of a rose, it doesn't matter how much people trust me, I'm still wrong. Right? So if you're using social trust, you want to be careful that you're using it in the case where opinion is really coming into the issue. So this idea of not conflating opinion and fact is an important one. And because facts are a very important part of science, you don't want to be using social trust where you shouldn't be. So that's one context. Another place where you might have a limitation from using social trust is scalability issues. So computing trust between people at this point is something that takes a while to do. We don't have any really highly efficient algorithms for computing trust in a personalized way. So if you have lots and lots of scientists and you're trying to compute trust between them, scalability could be a problem. And then finally, you have the issue of context. So as a computer scientist, I will have trust in other computer scientists in my subfield, so artificial intelligence or human-computer interaction. And I may also trust scientists about physics or biology, but there's that context there. So just because I trust, say, a computer scientist because I know their work doesn't mean I can trust them about other types of science. So because there's a context to trust, you need a lot of information in order to get a good estimate of how much to trust someone in a particular context, which may not necessarily be available. And that's just because it's a lot of work for people to express all of their preferences or to get dense enough data sets that you can, you know, infer it about a lot of different contexts.
Jen Golbeck, thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Jen Golbeck writes on trusting science on the World Wide Web. Read her perspective in this week's Science. Most of the recent energy policy debate in the U.S. Congress centers on offshore drilling, but legislators are also looking at other kinds of energy research and development. Here with the policy update is Science Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny.
The House Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming held a hearing last Wednesday where witnesses testified about the importance of a broad portfolio of energy R&D. In particular, new technologies could help increase U.S. competitiveness, mitigate global climate change, and address energy security. Susan Hockfield, president of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, testified about the importance of investments in energy to students and universities. Hockfield said, "The students' interest is absolutely deafening, and one of my fears is that if we don't fund the kinds of research that will fuel innovation, these very brilliant students will see that a bright future actually lies elsewhere." In addition to such testimony, legislators may also consider a report from the Nonpartisan Council on Competitiveness, which was released the day before the hearing. The report calls on the next president to increase investment in R&D and create a $200 billion National Clean Energy Bank. Presidential candidates, too, are weighing in. Republican nominee John McCain calls energy security and sustainability one of the prevailing issues of our time. McCain has proposed a new national energy strategy known as the Lexington Project to achieve independence from foreign oil by 2025. He also has declared a commitment to becoming the world leader in green technologies and announced plans for a $300 million prize for development of a next-generation battery package. Democratic nominee Barack Obama has proposed a series of programs that, taken together, would represent $150 billion in federal investment over the next 10 years in clean energy research, development, and deployment. His plan includes basic research to develop alternative fuels and chemicals, new vehicle technology, next-generation nuclear facilities, and technology to capture and store carbon emissions from coal power plants.
That was Science Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science news. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to talk about how giving someone the cold shoulder can literally give them a cold shoulder, why presents aren't as exciting for old people, and finally, how our body knows if we're saying a word correctly, even if we can't hear ourselves say it.
Well, let's start with the psychological cold shoulder, giving you the literal cold shoulder. How's that work?
Well, Rob, this has to do with something known as embodied cognition. And that's the link between something we think about and something we may actually feel.
So being ignored actually would affect the body in some way?
Exactly. And this study stems from a study that was done a couple years ago, where researchers wanted to see if there was a link between our feelings of moral good and how clean we felt. And in the older study, what they did was they had some people think about unethical acts that they did, such as shoplifting, and had other people think about something nice they did, like caring for a sick friend. And then both groups of people were given the choice between an antiseptic towelette or a pencil as a gift for participating in the study. And the people who thought about shoplifting were much more likely to take the antiseptic towelette than the pencil, indicating that these mental feelings of bad morals actually translated into a physical feeling of uncleanliness. And so in this new study, the same team of researchers wanted to see if there was a similar link between giving somebody the cold shoulder and actually feeling cold. And what they did was they recruited 65 volunteers and they split them into two groups. And they had one group of people think about an episode from their past where they were socially excluded. Maybe they weren't picked for a sports team or being friendless the first week of college. And they had the other people think about a more positive experience, being with friends, say. And then they asked the two groups of people to rate the temperature of the room. And what they found is the volunteers who were thinking about social exclusion rated the room about 4 degrees colder than those who were thinking about being with friends.
So they felt the room was colder, but it didn't actually mean that their body temperature was colder.
Right. They didn't actually measure their body temperature. It was all psychological. They just reported lower temperatures. And then the team extended these findings and did another set of experiments where they also divided a group of people into two groups. And this time they had the people play a game of toss on a computer. And the person would sit in front of the computer and they thought they were playing three other people who were represented by people on the computer. And the idea was to toss a ball back and forth between these people. But there really wasn't any other people. It was just the computer controlling those people on the computer. And sometimes the computer would play toss with the person, or the person thought they were playing toss with the other people on the computer. And sometimes the computer would exclude the volunteer from the game of toss so that just the people on the computer were playing toss.
So the real person was playing with the computer, and the computer either included them in the game or excluded them from the game.
Exactly. And the people that were excluded from the game were much more likely to seek a hot cup of soup or a hot cup of coffee afterwards than the people who felt included in the game.
Again, this feeling of coldness, but they didn't still measure the body temperature.
Right.
So does that further expand on what psychologists are calling this embodied cognition?
Yeah, it does. And what experts are saying is that what's exciting about this is that it's really further establishing this idea that even these abstract thoughts that we have can be translated into concrete experiences.
Well, from feeling cold by being excluded to not being so excited in getting a present, what evidence is there that that happens to old people?
Well, of course, there's the anecdotal evidence. In the story that we report online, the author uses the example of Christmas morning, where a young pair of kids gets up and anxiously, you know, skips breakfast or wolfs down their breakfast and rips open their presents while their grandparents just sort of hang out in the kitchen and maybe read the paper and maybe amble slowly into the living room eventually to open their presents. But it gets this idea that the older we get, the less excited we are about reward. Now, whether that reward is a present or maybe even just winning something, it's really anecdotal evidence. But a team of researchers wanted to see if there was anything actually happening on a physiological level that would back up these anecdotal reports.
So they looked at brain scans or something like that?
Right. They took brain scans of a group of people that averaged about 25 years old and another group of people that averaged about 66 years old. And they had these people sit down in front of a computer and watch a slot machine. And to simulate a reward, sometimes the slot machines would hit a jackpot and volunteers were told they won X amount of money, and sometimes the slot machines wouldn't hit the jackpot. And all the while, the researchers were monitoring their brain activity. And what they found was that in both groups, there was an increase in a neurochemical called dopamine. And this has been shown to be responsible for our response to rewards in the past. So that made sense. The people that were seeing the jackpots were showing this increase in dopamine. But what was different between the young people and the old people was that in the young people, in response to this spike in dopamine, there was an increase in activity in their part of their brain called the prefrontal cortex, which is involved in our higher level decision making. And the older people, even though they had this spike in dopamine, didn't register this increase. In fact, they actually had less activity in this region of their brain. They also showed less activity in brain areas that control arousal, suggesting that they were less excited about the thought of getting a reward.
So the signal got put out there, but it received less of a response in the older people.
Exactly.
So less excited at the thought of a reward, but what about this prefrontal cortex? What's the impact there on decision making?
Well, researchers know that the prefrontal cortex, because it's involved in decision making, is also important for things like multitasking. So what the study also suggests is that people might have a harder time multitasking as they grow older. So it's not just not being as excited about presents on Christmas. The study also suggests that as we grow older, our brain just has a decreased ability to make major decisions like, say, deciding on a health insurance policy or investing your life savings.
Well, from how the brain registers a reward to how the brain registers whether we've said a word correctly, how does that happen for people not able to hear it? I presume these are experiments in deaf people?
Well, these are experiments in deaf people. And the reason they did these experiments in deaf people is because researchers have noticed that when people go deaf as adults, they still retain the ability to speak correctly for years afterwards, suggesting that we don't need to hear ourselves speak in order to speak correctly. And so a team of researchers suspected that it wasn't just these audio cues that were important for helping us enunciate. There must be some sort of physical cues. There must be something having to do with, say, the muscles in our faces or our tongues or even our vocal tracts. Some way our body knows physically whether we're saying a word correctly. But how do you go about proving that?
So it's a test of muscle memory. Is that it?
Well, maybe that's not the right term, but we really don't know what the right term is. So what the researchers did in this study was they invented an unusual apparatus. It was this robot that attaches to somebody's mouth. And what the robot does is it makes subtle manipulations to the person's jaw, say lowering it by a certain amount as a person speaking. And you can actually see a picture of the apparatus on the website. And what this team of researchers did was they had a group of deaf people and a group of hearing people sit down and attach them to this apparatus. And they had them say various words like sass and saw, words that use vowels that open the mouth really wide. And in the first set of experiments, they had the deaf people wear their cochlear implants so they could still hear the noises they were making. And what they found was that in both groups in that set of experiments, if the robot was manipulating these volunteers' mouths to make them try to say a word incorrectly, the people would adjust. they would know, okay, that doesn't feel right, and they would adjust their jaw however they had to say the word correctly. But in the next set of experiments, the researchers just focused on the deaf people, and this time they had them turn their cochlear implants off so that they couldn't hear the words they were saying. And even in this case, the deaf people still readjusted their jaw to say the word correctly, even if they couldn't hear themselves saying the word incorrectly. So this is strong evidence that it's not just hearing what we say, it's also feeling what we say in the muscles in our mouth and our tongue and our vocal tract that helps us say words correctly.
Well, does this have any implications for, say, speech therapists or people who are working with deaf people or those who can't hear all that well?
Yeah, experts are saying that this could help inspire new speech therapy approaches to help people who do have problems with how they make words. But experts also say that it's important not to completely discount our ability to hear ourselves talk. After all, that's how we learn to talk in the first place when we're infants. So feeling is part of the equation, but hearing, especially early on, is an essential part of helping us say words correctly.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now?
Well, Rob, we're looking into stories about how our sun could have been born very far away from where it is right now, how genetically modified crops help protect their neighbor crops from pesticides, and finally, what our political views have to do with our startle reflexes. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news site of science. You can catch up on the latest science news at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the September 19th, 2008 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.